Hi, I'm Kirsty Rice, and I am totally crap at podcast introductions, but I'm reasonably good at expat life and travelling with kids. This is my friend Nikki Moffat. Hi. We're the two fat expats, perhaps a little bit literally or maybe even metaphorically, but mostly because we believe that expat life should be lived large. We want you to fill it up to the brim until it's overflowing. Nikki and I are serial expats.
Yep, I've lived in four countries over the last 14 years, which has meant I've climbed Kili in Africa, played tennis in the deep American South, surfed my way around Durban while mastering dumplings and banking in Hong Kong. I can speak taxi Cantonese, I can add some hard R's when needed, and I'm currently touching up my high school German, and I do have a dirndl in my wardrobe.
I've lived in seven countries over the past 17 years and have managed to have a few children along the way. Four kids, four different countries, and I haven't broken one of them yet. I still can't pack a suitcase properly, but a few career highlights have been protests in Jakarta, backyard monkeys in KL, and making my way around the funky cold Medina in Libya. There's been bumps and hurdles in my expat life with chemo in Qatar and boarding school for big kids, but we've made it. I've finally found an online gig that allows me to travel. Only took me about 12 years. Easy, really.
And that's why we're here. Each week we talk about expat life and try to find solutions to expat questions. Now, let's get on with the show.
Hello, Nikki Moffat. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Kirsty Rice. How are you today?
I'm good. I've just got back from the gym, which was good. It's my husband's birthday today, so I see cake in my future. And then I'm off to Australia tomorrow night to see my girls. So really, it's a pretty good week so far. How about you? What's been happening with you?
Well, it's the last day of our midterm break, for which I am very grateful.
Yes.
And my husband did a German exam last night and he got 46 out of 50 for his grammar, which I said is just outrageous. Wow. No one should get that when they're an old person learning a new language. That's just too high a score. So, yes.
Can I ask, because obviously when you guys moved to Hamburg, you had, you know, a bit of background with German, and I was of the understanding that Sam maybe not so much. But Sam is, of course, in the workplace every day with Germans, other Germans, and you're going off to school a few times a week to learn German. So how are we tracking in the competitive nature of the spousal language program?
Well, see, here's the thing. He's never going to accept that I'm better than him, and he will. It's like skiing. He thinks if he goes faster, that means he's a better skier. But I did learn German at school, and I've lived in Germany before. So whatever happens, but it's so interesting because I've never seen him study. So we went on a trip last week and we came back on Friday night. And so Saturday, Sunday and Monday he had off work because his exam was last night. He spent studying. So he evicted me from my study and he took it over. And he honestly spent a lot of time. And I've come in this morning to record and there's cards and there's this and there's that. There's all sorts of study things. I think, wow, he's quite a nerd when it comes to this. And then he got home from the exam last night and he was really disappointed that he got 46 out of 50. I was like, dude, that is awesome. I think when I did the same exam, I got like 27. But I was like, that's a pass on my grammar. That's all I need.
Now, I seem to remember stories like this from your uni days, though. Is this not the same guy that when exams used to come, he'd break up with you?
It actually is. And I said to him, I've never seen you study because you always used to break up with me. I said divorce was a bit expensive for just a lowly German exam. So this is the conversation that we had. And I said the exact same thing to him yesterday because I was like, I have never seen you study. And now I know. Like I study by just, you know, reading a few things. He's a very good studier. Yeah, osmosis, that's me.
Okay, let's kick off with what was hot in the group. And of course, when we talk about the group, we talk about the Two Fat Expats Facebook group. You should come and join us if you haven't already. I think we've now got 3,800 people, which freaks me out, Nikki, because I swear that was only a couple of weeks ago that we had 3,000. So
I know.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you to the 800 who have joined. And on that, how amazing was Maretta's map? So Maretta did, and I don't even know, Nikki, you might have to explain it. Like, what was, how did, where did she come up with the map? Like, what was the program?
Okay, so I don't know what the program is, but the map is in another group that she belongs to, and it just is to show the geographic location of all the people that belong to that group. So she said, look, I've stolen the idea from another group, so let's use the map. But the best thing about the map, I thought, was so she said you need three coloured pins. So you're not just dropping a pin where you live, you're dropping a pin where you're from, where you live, and then the places that you've lived. So green is where you live, yellow is where you're from, and then red is the places that you've lived. And I just love it. I love looking on there and like looking for countries where no one's lived, which really, yes, there's not actually that many.
No, it was incredible. Like, there were so many pins and the range of places that people had lived. And I loved it when some people would come up and say, I was sure I was going to be the only person that had lived in, you know, Rwanda or whatever. But no, there's 10 of us.
And that's right.
Like, it was really, really, it was a great visual. Like, I think sometimes, Nikki, I think when you, particularly with a podcast, when it feels like it's just you and I having a chat and it goes out into the ether, when you actually see the people that, you know, where they're placed and where they've been and who they are, it's incredible. I loved it. So if anyone hasn't seen it, I think it's still pinned as a post. So I think it's still up the top of the group.
Yeah, you can go in there. And speaking of visual, Kirsty, you introduced another visual activity in the Facebook group this week, which was the getting on the GIF/GIF train. And is it really GIF or is it GIF? I never know.
I thought, well, I would love to see everyone's explanation of their expat life. Oh, far out. That was so, so funny. It was so funny. One of my favourites was Nova, who did the fantastic scene from Mad Men, the very last scene, I think it is, in Mad Men, when, oh, no, not the last, because I remember the last now, but it had Peggy strolling through the office with cigarette hanging out of her mouth. Like, it's a total, I'm owning this, you know, this is mine, I've got this, I'm so cool. But the range of emotions that you saw, like, you can see the people that were so struggling in their expat life, who were like banging their heads against fridges and, you know, throwing, you know, small children throwing tantrums, to this one person who's on Jeopardy saying, does anybody here speak English? Yeah.
And the one, the so one with the Wi-Fi, the little kid saying, there's no Wi-Fi, it's just been tough. That's everybody's expat life, right, in the beginning.
There's a guy getting off a camel and he just goes head first in the middle of the desert getting off the camel.
I had a look last night, just another quick look, because I can go back and look for ages and see things I haven't seen before. But there was one of Milhouse just in a park throwing the frisbee to himself. So he throws the frisbee, then he walks to the other side and then throws it back. And I was just like, oh, my God, look at that. It's so good. There was an awesome one.
But didn't you find you could recognize your expat life in just about every one of them? Like, you're like, oh, yeah, been there. Oh, yeah, I know that one. Yep, I know that one. You know, one minute, there's someone, I think it was Kelly, did the Dorothy, there's no place like home.
Yes.
There's no place like home. Yeah, it was great. It was really good. Anyway, someone suggested that we should do one next on which country we're in, like a GIF for which country you're in. I think that would be good as well.
Yes, excellent. Another things this week, Kirsty, Doha Book Club.
Oh, it was a ripper. It was so, so good. So I think it was just over a month ago, I decided that I wanted to start a book group. And so I put a note out on the 4 Kids 20 Suitcases page and in Two Fat Expats to see if anybody else was keen. And it It was born solely from my pure jealousy of my girlfriend Carol's book group. Carol's had this book group in Australia for about 20 years. And because they've become so close over those 20 years, they, you know, now are at the stage, and, you know, they're all in their 50s now, so they've got probably a little bit of financial independence and independence from their children, those that have them, to be able to say, oh, we're reading a book based in Tuscany. Maybe next June we should all go to Tuscany and have our book group there. Yeah, which they did. So I just felt I had been in book groups in different expat locations, but somehow it just didn't happen here. I think I went to one here, and then I kind of didn't read the book, and then felt embarrassed about going again, and then that, you know, it kind of just fizzled. So I thought, no, I really want to do this. I want a book group. So we made some rules. We made it 15 people. You can't miss more than two book groups without being kicked out. We made it that whoever chooses the book, they have the book group at their house. And what we did that I really liked, because I have been in book groups before where I haven't really had the venue and I've been nervous about the catering. And so what we've done this time is said, seven people bring a bottle, seven people bring a plate. So then you're not having to supply all the booze, you know, when it's your turn to host.
Of course, there won't be any booze, though, because it's illegal.
Absolutely. And it meant that we actually did have oodles and oodles of food. I think I went a bit above and beyond. But someone very cleverly said, can you all please say what you're going to bring so we don't end up with seven plates of hummus and chips, which was very good. And it was great. Anyway, so the book we did was The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. And I've talked about it in previous podcasts, about the story of Henrietta Lacks and her amazing evolving cells that have gone on to save millions and millions of people. I thought it was a fantastic book, but the beautiful thing about book groups is obviously everybody has a different opinion. What was wonderful was we realised within our group we had a doctor and we had a nurse and we had people that had had cancer. So there were a lot of personal feelings about it as well within your careers and your experiences. My favorite quote of the night was from Catherine, who said, I actually enjoyed this discussion more than I enjoyed the book, which is that not a
That is the ultimate compliment. Well done.
And it was just a great display of the amazing mix of expat women you find on a location. Do you know, we just had such different women of different nationalities. You know, we had the Czechoslovakian who'd married the Belgian, who, you know, now they're both living in Doha, and we had some Australians, we had some Brits, and we had some Americans, we had some Canadians, you know, we had South Africans, we had everybody, and it just was a fantastic mix. Anyway, next month we're going to read The Hate You Give by Angie Thomas, and I won't talk about it today, but maybe talk about it in the next couple of weeks when we're talking about what we're reading. But it looks already, you can see when I went to download it, there were so many rave reviews about this is the book you have to be reading now. So I'm very, very excited. Now, Nikki, I want to know about you, though, because you had a little get-together of your own, a little bit more exotic than mine. You travelled to Paris.
Well, I did go to Paris. I had a coffee morning in Paris, which, you know, if someone has to do it, Kirsty, I put my hand up.
So where did you go? What did you do?
We went to a cafe called Carrette. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that properly, but that's the way it's spelled. And it was, if you sit in it when it's a sunny day, you can see the Eiffel Tower down the promenade. And it was amazing, amazing, amazing. It was like an authentic 1920s sort of cafe with all the tiling and the, you know, and the pastry windows were just amazing. Of course, I was doing I kept doing my 16-8 when I was there, so I was not eating. But I did go back to the cafe later with my family for lunch much later in the day because I was like, I'm coming back here. And the reason I wanted to come back was because Ingrid, who was there, who I believe you know from online for years and years,
yes,
she's a big follower of the blog.
I always think of Ingrid as the little pink suitcase because I think for as long as Ingrid has followed the blog, she has had the most stunning Facebook picture of this little pink, and it's the most beautiful pastel pink. But yes, I feel like I know Ingrid, but I've never met her, whereas you got to meet her.
I have met her, and she is just divine. It's so lovely. And she and her husband have returned to Paris on and off over the last sort of 15 years, I think, and they've been in there for 7 years at the moment. Anyway, she recommended this cafe as being very authentic, and it's in sort of a touristy area because it's not far from the Eiffel Tower. But it's the most sort of real Paris one. So the other ones was a little bit more touristic, but this was definitely there were lots of locals in there. And they had the most amazing macarons. And, oh, I've never had a macaron before. Do you know? I didn't think I'd like them. But she said they had the best ones in Paris. So I was like, I'm in. So we went back later in the day and my daughter and I took great delight in deciding. You know, we bought a beautiful box that was all wrapped and we chose them all from the window. And it was just amazing. But the coffee was originally suggested by Deborah. So Deborah, after 7 years in Moscow, she's finding her first year in Paris really tough. And I recognized a lot of things about Deborah from my first year in South Africa because I looked at her and I talked to her and I heard the things she had to say. And I was like, oh, I just really can see. And she thought, you know, 7 years in Moscow, how hard's it going to be in Paris? Because that's the way you'd think, right?
Yeah.
But she's really been struggling. She decided to live in the city versus the suburbs because she wanted to be around the city. She thought it would be better for making friends and all that kind of stuff. She's since had three friends move from Moscow and they've moved to the suburbs and their social life is amazing, fantastic, out of control. And she's in the city and she's not having the same response on that. So it was really interesting to have that conversation and really just see where she is. You know, when you get in the place in your head and it's really hard to sort of move out of it. But I think it was great for her to meet and these women. So Ingrid has been there for a long time. Christine went to Paris with her husband for 2 years, and 18 years later, they're still there. But they've actually still not made any plans to stay. They were renting a house originally, and then the landlord was going to sell it. And in France, the law is that you have to offer the tenant the first right of refusal. So the landlord offered them the house, and they thought, okay. They bought the house. So they've bought a house. Their children have been done all their schooling there. Yes.
Wow.
That thing's, yeah. So interesting, right? Things are just amazing when you go into it. The other thing that I thought, which I think, gosh, you know, I think of myself as quite a worldly person sometimes because I've spent this time living overseas. But when Deborah was talking about Moscow and how what a vibrant, amazing city it was, and how the restaurant scene was out of this world because, you know, the food was amazing. She said, but then the sanctions came. And, you know, after the sanctions, you know, the restaurants really had to change. And I was like, what? The sanctions affected the restaurants? You know, I just hadn't thought of the practicality of it. That in fact, you know, I mean, I don't know, you live in countries where it's much more obvious and you probably had thought about that. But I was like, wow, that didn't really occur to me that just because America puts sanctions on Russia, then the restaurants aren't really as good anymore, or they have to change all the cuisine they're serving. They have to, you know, they can't import certain types of food anymore.
Yes.
Anyway, I'm not as worldly as I thought. And then the other lady there was Kathy, who we lived in Hong Kong at the same time, but we didn't know each other. And this is her second time in France. She's married to a French guy. And she said it took her 14 years to get over the first time she lived in France. So she was a bit nervous about moving back. But she has moved back just outside Paris, a totally different location to where she lived before. Now she's got three children. She didn't have any last time and she's totally loving it. So it was just an amazing morning with these amazing women with all different stories and all at different stages of their lives and also their expat experiences. So it was so great to talk to them and so great that I didn't record anything or take any pictures. Except of the coffee cup.
Yes.
I apologize.
Oh,
I went
a
with
shame.
The best of
you know
intentions.
What? I do that all the time, though, Nikki. I do that all the time. I always forget to, you know, record it or, you know, photograph it or talk about it or whatever. Oh, they sound incredible. And Nat, so all of these women are in the Two Fat Expats Facebook group, right?
And that's they are, and they all are podcast listeners.
Am I right in guessing that you were saying that some of those women and friends of those women have enjoyed being out in the suburbs in Paris more than being in the city?
Yes. So it's very interesting. Yeah. So Deborah and Ingrid live in the city, and they Ingrid really enjoys it, and she thinks that Deborah will too in time. Yeah. But the other ones all live in the suburbs, and they have found their place and their communities.
Yes.
That being said, yes. They're near sort of some of the international schools. So there is a British school in the suburbs, and there is a, you know, different types of schools there that their children can go to.
Yeah.
But yes.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah. You know, when we went to Paris a few years ago, we were very, very lucky that we had good expat friends who were on assignment in Paris, and they went away in the holidays and gave us their house. And we were just down the street from the British international school, but out in the suburb where it was. And it wasn't a fantastic insight, because you did have to, you know, oh, if everyone's wondering, there's the mosque. Cool. But yeah, so you did have to, you know, train it into town, and it was a train and a bus, and it was quite involved, you know, to do it. But it gave you, you know, I often think that's quite the insight into a city, isn't it? To see how people live out in the burbs, not just see the fancy stuff that you see in the city. But yeah, that sounds amazing, Nikki. Go you. Well done for doing it. And thank you to Nikki's family for letting her have the morning off from holidays so that she could do it. Now, I just want to do one last thing before we move on to the hot topic of the week, was you mentioned your intermittent fasting and not eating. How's it going this week?
Well, it's good. I lost 2 pounds when I was in Paris. Oh, who knew?
That's impressive. Bloody hell.
Well, I think it's because I was out of the house. So I didn't have any access to food. I ate pizza. I ate a lot of French fries. I drank wine. But I just ate in my window, and we did loads of walking, both in Brussels. We went to Brussels first. We did a chocolate-making course in Brussels. I mean, I ate a lot of chocolate.
What is your window? Is your window is when? From
midday? I eat usually from midday or 1 or 2. Like, it depends. Like, sometimes if I'm doing something and I'm not hungry, I don't sort of eat till 2. But between 2 and 8 or 12 and 8, 2 and 8, around there.
Yeah, me too, Nikki. I have managed. I think I'm up to 8 kilos now that I've lost.
That's
and
awesome.
For the first time, tried on those white pants this morning, you know, the ones I was talking about last week that I could not do up. I can now do them up. They look bloody hideous, but I can now do them up. They're not pretty, and they're white linen, so it's really not pretty. But progress, I can do them up.
By Christmas, you'll be wearing them to cocktail parties.
Okay, let's move on to the hot topic of the week, which of course was international schools. Now, we've done an episode in the past about international schools, and we've talked about when you're looking for international schools and choosing, you know, whether you do British or you do American or Australian or, you know, whatever you would choose, immersion, whatever. But I came at the international school conversation this week in our Facebook group because I wanted to talk about maybe some of the pitfalls, because I think, Nikki, when we're on this expat gig that we are, we quite often see schools in that Pollyanna happy, happy way of, you know, of what we get sold, that, you know, our children are having this amazing international experience and it's all very intercultural. And one of the big ones you hear in all schools is our children are going to be global active citizens. And, you know, and it's easy to go to International Day and see the 76 different nationalities and watch these kids all hang together beautifully and go, wow, this is just an incredible experience. But I did want to talk about some of the pitfalls because they're there and it would be remiss to not talk about the pitfalls. It's a tough one for me because I obviously have four children and they're all at school at the moment and I don't want anyone to think that I am talking, you know, going hard on my own particular school. I don't know how you feel about this, Nikki, with talking about schooling with kids at school.
Look, I don't mind talking about it. I think every school is different and I think schools are different for each child. So I don't think every school can be perfect for every child, you know, and having four children, I can imagine that that's an even bigger call, you know.
Yes. So I guess needing a place to start, I thought Emma said it well when she said her kids had been at three international schools. One was amazing, one was good, and one was bad. And like all schools, there's highlights and there's downfalls. But she loved how international schools could help shape them into confident global citizens. And I thought, you know, that seemed to be the general gist of it all. You know, when you looked, there were some people that just abhorred their schools, like they could not stand them, and others who thought they were the best place on earth. I guess one of the comments that I identified with was Janine Pearson, and she said they had their two girls in IB schools and they learnt how to be risk takers and they learnt how to be citizens of the world, but they were behind on basics such as fraction, spelling and comprehension. And she said they changed them into a different curriculum and now they're back in Australia at boarding school. And she said six different schools over 10 years has not helped. But if given my time again, I would not have sent them to an IB. I just feel that they missed out on the basics at a very important time in their schooling. Now, my reason for why I could kind of identify with it was, you know, I had a child who came to Qatar in grade one and, you know, had a wonderful elementary school experience where she absolutely thrived and loved it. She was a real worker. And she got to middle school and things kind of fell apart a bit. And I remember we went to go and see a teacher who said to us, "Ooh, you know, she's really got some gaps in the basics." And my response was, "Well, that's interesting because she's been here the whole time." And it was my first time where I thought, you can tell a parent that in the expat world. You can say, "Hey, they're really missing some gaps in the basics." And an expat parent will think, "Well, shit, you know, that's probably my fault, or that would be because we moved from here to here, or that would be because we weren't at this, you know, fancy international school. We were just at our suburban school and they're probably not as good." Do you know, it's an easy line to sell.
It's also an easy line for children to adopt. So when we came here and my son had to go in for testing to the school before the school year started to check his sort of level of English, because not everyone's native English and math, and he walked in, he said, "Yeah, by the way, I missed half of third grade, so I missed half my times tables and I don't do cursive." So that's, he just announced that. The little woman's like, "That'll be fine." You know, here's this eighth grader telling her, "I missed half of third grade. That's my story."
And, you know, the other side of that is I remember, can you remember the old days where you'd go and do temp jobs at recruiting companies and you'd have to do a test before? And, yeah, like you'd do typing and then you'd do a grammar and then you'd do a general math and whatever. And I remember fractions just used to get me every time. And I'd think, where was I when fractions was taught? Like, how did I miss that bit? Now, I went to the same school, you know, all the way through and I was in the same Australian system, but I obviously was looking out the window the day that fractions were taught, or how, you know, I really don't know how I sort of got through school without it. So I think it can work both ways. But maybe, Nikki, if we kick off by listening, because I know you've done two interviews and you've done one with a parent and one with a teacher. Shall we kick off with your interview that you did with a parent?
Sure, yeah. So this is Jessica. Jessica is new to the international school system. She has four children, very similar to yours in that she's got two girls who are older and her boys are younger. And she's 1 year into her international move.
Yeah, no, that was the biggest stress of moving here, was moving here and knowing that there was basically one school choice that was applicable for us. And that was a combination of the city that we're in. We needed English speaking. Often, I think we knew if you move, you could put your kids in a local school. But our oldest kids were old enough that they didn't have the wiggle room to basically lose an academic year spent learning the new language. So we didn't have, we could do that with our little ones, but not with older ones, if that makes sense. So that really left us with literally one choice. And so that put an unfortunate pressure on the one choice for it to be a good one. And so there's a question of how much does it have to be good enough? It's certainly, I would love it to be better. It's, if there was another choice that was stronger, we would probably take it. I probably shouldn't even say probably, we would take it. But when it comes down to, is the school good enough given that we like the job. Do you know what I mean? Is the school, or I guess conversely, is the school bad enough that we shouldn't take this job? And it's kind of got to be pretty bad to not take a job, right? Yeah. I mean, what if you really need the job? Or what if the job is a perfect stepping stone or exactly where you need to be in your career? I mean, there's a lot of reasons that you take a job, from the base of needing it to it being the right fit for this moment, for your career, for your trajectory, for what have you. So I think it's a luxury to be in a position where you could not take an ideal fit job because the schools aren't great. It is a luxury. And hopefully it's a luxury that most people have, just like driving a car or having a car. But but not everybody has that, you know, or feels like that choice is as equally weighted. And I certainly felt like that, you know, I think we felt like this job was such a great fit and such an important fit that the school had to really be quite an ill fit for our children to make it worth not accepting a job because of the school.
We've got two girls who are in grade 10 and grade 9, so it's likely that they'll be sort of finishing out in this academic environment in your current situation. So what is that like for you and for them to have changed completely environments to a different system, and how do they think that's going to affect them, or do they have any thoughts on that?
Oh my gosh, they had so many thoughts. They had a bazillion thoughts the first couple months. And I think that they are coming to peace with being here and finding the upsides to it, which I think is the right way to go. I think there are a lot of things that they still miss, and they're old enough that what they perceive to be lacking in this school, I have to say, is right on. I can't disagree with really anything that they find that's a fault of the school. They nail it on the head, whether it is too many local students, to school spirit, to the sense of community, to, you know, you name it, to kind of an honor code and people really having to uphold it. They're right about what they perceive to be lacking. And what I think that they've, where I think they've gotten in a year of being here, is also starting to see the big picture. We've always talked about, you know, you're right, and I wish I could change it. And I'm trying to support positive change as much as I can at school and at home, but we can't change it. So what can we do with it? And that you've got to do the whole picture comparison. So we can be back where we were, which in our case was home, and we can be doing the carpool, driving a lot more, a lot less independence, and be in a great school. Or you can be in a school that's not as great, but have this great expat experience, have a lot more independence because the infrastructure and the transportation here is so great that really they can be teenagers and safely really get around. You know, I think the school becomes part of the bigger picture of being an expat. So I think that they're better. And I think that their ability to try new things in a school that's not as rigorous has been great. I don't think that in a really competitive school that they were in before, they would have, say, tried out for a sport that they'd never played before. I think this has allowed them to take some risks. Same, the bigger ones are right in their criticisms of school, but the little ones are too. They're dead on with what they don't like about the school. They're absolutely right. But what they're right about, I mean, to some extent, and this is maybe being too optimistic and too half glass full about that kind of the, what we really find, to be honest, incredibly frustrating and disappointing about the school, is it's also a kind of an eye-opening growth moment for them that, you know, not everybody follows rules perfectly. Not everybody is kind. Not everybody does everything the same way. The hard part is, as an expat, is the guilt of inadequacy and thinking that they are bearing an unfair burden of the impact of our move. I think that's at the crux of disappointment about a school that you wish was better or stronger or a better fit for your kids, is feeling like then your kids bear more of a burden because of your choice to live in a certain place than they should. Because let's face it, moving's hard enough. Making new friends, that's all hard enough, you know? You add another hurdle. You make it, you know, as we've talked about before, you can have a race with hurdles and without hurdles, and you add more hurdles to the race when the school is not as good as you hoped it would be. Having had experience more kind of on the board level of schools, there's also an interesting piece to me, which is there's so much transience in the international school community, from the teachers to the heads, to each division, to the parents, that having the sense of community and what can be the strength when you're at a school where you stay for a long time, or if you go local, that's really hard. And the impact of a school is really dominated by the head of the school and the heads of each division and kind of the feel that's set. And so when you have a head of school change more frequently than it might, if you are, I'm going to say native, for lack of a better term, you know, you just have that many more opportunities for, I think, a potentially negative effect on how the school is run. And it's really, I'm amazed at what I've seen when you put a phenomenal head of school, the phenomenal changes that it has and the phenomenal impacts it has on the school. And then within that, if you have a strong head of each division, how much a school can absolutely soar if those people in those positions are really strong. And there's so much transience in the international community that if you get any of those weak links, it's really hard to be an academically superior, great community, really strong school with those weak links. And there's just so many more opportunities to have those weak links if an international school. You know, I think within the expat community, there are certainly more desirable postings than others, and that's certainly got to be the same for teachers. And I think you're kind of looking for that delta of a really neat place to live and a salary that allows you to live a life that is exciting for you to live with the family size that you would like to have, et cetera, as a staff person. And that goes the same for the, you know, the head positions. And so where does that leave you if you're not, you know, London, Paris, Hong Kong, Singapore, you know, where does that leave the rest of the schools that are maybe less desirable?
Jessica is one of those amazing people, I think, that is so eloquent in what she says. I would give anything to be able to be so succinct in my conversation. Did you find that when you were speaking to her? She's so good at explaining her feelings and the situation.
I do agree with that. And the other thing is, as a parent, it's very interesting because she's got experience in school boards. So I also thought that she brought an interesting perspective to the school, the administration part as well.
So where is Jessica based?
Jessica is based in Hamburg.
Right. Okay. And why does she only have a choice of one school? Is there really truly only one? Is it an American thing or what is it?
No, it's really truly so. Her eldest children were too old, as my son was, to go into a German school or a German immersion school, because the pickup of having to learn a new language, it's too much for someone at that grade level when they're having to pick up all the science and the history and math, like learning math in another language. So there really is only one international school here at the time that could have accommodated the family.
Wow. And do they have all four at the same school now?
Yep. So all four kids are at the same school. So two in the senior school, so grade 10 and 9, and then two in the junior school, 3 and 5.
Do you know, my biggest takeaway from Jessica was I thought she did so well at explaining the expat intricacies of these decisions that we have to make in our life. Because if my husband and I lived back in Australia, our choice of schooling would maybe be based on where our house was and what the public schooling was like there. But really, my husband's job wouldn't come into it at all, do you know? But they had to weigh up the whole career opportunity and, you know, the trajectory for him and then the schooling and how that affects the children. And, you know, it was just such a more heartfelt family decision, and that the family has this very open conversation about it. Do you know, I don't think ever with my parents would I have discussed the quality of education that I was getting because of where we lived.
Yeah, look, I think education is also very important to her. As you can tell, she's very passionate about it, and that's why she's been involved in school boards, etc., in the past. So, and I agree with that. The other thing is it's their first expat experience, so she's also sort of, I thought it was interesting to talk to her because she's sort of feeling her way through it and experiencing international schooling for the first time. So I thought it was a good person to talk to sort of get a sort of a brand new perspective on it and an understanding, you know, because do you remember what it first felt like? And sort of, and the other thing is her kids have been to school in her home country. My kids have never been to school in my home country or their home country. So I don't have any comparisons. I've just got moved country to country and sort of had to make do as we go based on the schooling choices. So I thought it was good from that perspective.
Yeah, yeah. And you're right. It is. It's completely different. I've only just experienced from, you know, my two girls going home, I've only just experienced what that's like to be in the Australian school system. And it's bizarre that, you know, here my Australian husband and I, have, you know, we've been married for 19 years and raised four kids who all, you know, see themselves as Aussies. We had no idea how the Australian school system worked. We'd never enrolled a child or, you know, been a part of it. And it is culturally, it's so different in Australia, the feeling of a school and the conversations they have and the activities that happen. I think one of the big things that came out of people, like, I think one of the biggest fears was the amount of people that talked about their concern and worry about what happens to their child when they get home and how they're going to fit in and where they are. Like, it's always the case, you know, people always will say to me now that my children are older, you know, how did she fit in? Do you know, where was she academically? Where do you feel she was scholastically? Do you know? And the one thing I will say is, you know, my children started off in a Brit system, went to a Canadian system, then ended up in an American system, and they did a little bit of French immersion along the way. So they've you know, had a bit of everything. But what I will say about my daughter who went from being in a very large American school with over 2,000 kids in an IB school, she preferred the Australian system in that she didn't do as much collaborative work as she had done at the international school. She liked it because it was quieter, because of course there's, it brings in the thing that she's now at an all-girls school, so she said it's far quieter than it was at a busy, loud American school with, you know, jocks and, you know, boys. She felt that her school was perhaps a little sexist in that, you know, the boys got the better baseball field, the boys got to, you know, they were sort of the heroes a lot of the time.
Interesting.
And, you know, yeah, and this is, and I will reiterate, this is just one person's opinion. This, I'm not saying that this is definitely the case for the school. This was just an opinion of hers while she was there. And so she sort of felt, you know, there was, you know, the louder and more dramatic and whatever, that you were more likely to be heard, whereas she didn't find that so much when she got to school in Australia. And she said, of course, there have been things now, and I think I wrote it in the comments, was she said the other day in history, her history teacher in Australia, who happens to be an Englishman who emigrated to Australia 20 years ago, but he said something about the Spanish Civil War, and she looked up and went, wait, what? What? When did that happen? I was in hysterics, and it hadn't occurred to me that that wouldn't have been covered at all in the American school that she was in. Now, she said she could tell you, she thinks just about everything about American history. But then interestingly, in the thread we had a lot of Americans who had kids at American international schools who felt they weren't getting enough American history.
Yeah, I did see that people, and I guess it's, my kids don't know any Australian history, really, apart from what I try and impose on them when they're not really that interested. So, you know, I worry that one day they'll live in Australia and they'll have no historical or cultural references to refer to.
You know, that's part of my why we watch Australian television series, you know, really run-of-the-mill, everyday Australian television series. Why I don't mind if the kids want to watch The Bachelor or The Bachelorette, because, you know, like I'm hoping those pop culture references, you know, will mean something to them later in life, you know, that they'll remember certain things, you know, why we sing, you know, why my son and I were floating around the pool the other day singing "Give Me a Home Among the Gum Trees" with lots of gum trees, because, you know, I really do. I think I almost overcompensate in that way, because I know that they're not getting, they're not growing up with those Australianisms. But then, you know, that's what. You can't have your cake and eat it too. That's why we choose this other life. We want them to have this other amazing international experience.
So, of all the comments in the group, my favorite was from Mariska. And she said, "We try to stick to the same curriculum. We try to stick with non-profit schools. We're at our third international school. And although the curriculum has been the same, all the schools are completely different." And so she's got this sort of four rules. So it location, the more interesting the location, the easier it is to attract the best teachers, which is kind of what Jessica was saying in her interview. The parent community, the number of expats versus locals attending the school, again, sort of something that Jessica picked up on. The philosophy of the leadership team, and it also depends how your children are learning. So she's got two children at either end of the learning curve, and of course, it's much easier if you're a good student to adapt into comparison to when a child has learning needs. So I really related to that as well. So I think that's why that was my favorite comment. But she sort of encompassed a lot of things.
And that is a big one in the location you're in of how attractive it is, because and you know, maybe this is the time, Nikki, that we talk to your teacher interview, because I think you have to ask yourself in some locations about the vetting process and how people were chosen and whether they just quickly got someone or not. I think one of the big things I find with teachers at our school is they come as a couple usually. So you know, and this is, oh, I was going to say, pardon the pun, talking out of school, but quite often there's a little background with, well, you know, the wife, she was amazing, but the husband was a sort of a ran with, you know, came along as well. Do you know? And it may sound unfair, but sometimes it's true. Like you might, I know, you might find that a couple came as a package deal, and yes, she was the most amazing history teacher, and he ended up teaching visual arts, but actually he wasn't really fully qualified to teach visual arts. He just knew he was pretty good on an apple, and you know, we needed someone to fill the gap, and there he was. Now, sometimes those situations work fabulously. Absolutely fabulously, in that weren't you so lucky that you had that other person there to fill the gap? But sometimes it's a complete gyp that you end up with that person teaching your child. Do you know, you're sort of making do with having that person because the other person was IB qualified to do whatever and they were fabulous.
Well, I spoke with Amanda. Amanda was a teacher in Kuwait, Dubai, and Qatar, and she now lives on an island in Greece. But she was a teacher in those three countries. And I asked the same questions. How were you recruited? How did it happen? How did you end up there? And I spoke to her for a long time, and I hope you enjoy listening to it.
I was teaching in a really rough inner city comprehensive school in London, in Southeast London, and it was really hard work, really rewarding, but it also didn't pay enough to actually live. So I kind of looked around. I'd travelled a little bit in the past anyway. I'm ex-British Forces, and I wanted to travel some more. So I got onto the TESS website during the half term in the May, decided, right, that's it, put my notice in, apply for a job. And in July, I was flying out to Kuwait. Yeah, I applied for four jobs. Got offered all four and then kind of went, oh, now which one do I take?
Oh, were they all in the Middle East?
Yeah, they were actually. Yeah. One was in Syria. Different place then, though.
How do you interview for that? Was that via phone or Skype, or did they fly you out?
Initially, it was just sending off your CV and filling in application forms. Then it was followed up by a phone call. It wasn't Skype back then, because most places didn't have internet that was that good. We certainly didn't when I went to work in Kuwait. And I did actually meet the woman that managed the school in London for an interview.
Okay, so you went to Kuwait. What kind of school was it?
It was a British curriculum school. So it was the English school. And it was basically teaching what I had been back home doing O-levels, GCSEs and A-levels. And not very different, but it was the students, of course, that were so different. Yeah. And the way the school was run that was so different, because it was run for profit.
Parents also different? Parental level of involvement?
Completely different, yeah. It was, when you're teaching in rough schools in the UK, you've got parents who are disinterested for a different reason. In the Middle East, you had very rich parents who were just not there. They were absent and disinterested, but in a different way. And then you had the expat parents who tended to be too interested, if that makes sense. You kind of got the extreme of the parents who didn't care at all, or those who came along and said, Billy got 99% last week and then he only got 98% this week. And you'd be kind of like, give Billy a break.
And it was a for-profit school. So how did you, yeah, as a teacher, how did you find that different?
Completely different from the point of view that we were only on annual contracts. So we arrived in the summer, did our initiation and all the rest of it. And then in the Christmas, we were waiting to hear if we were going to be employed the following year, if we were going to be offered another contract. And everyone in the school, from the headmistress all the way down, every single level, was an annual contract. So the first few months of the year, people were almost stabbing each other in the back to make sure they got a contract the following year. Sometimes it didn't make sense. Other times it did. I remember we had one teacher who came out and she'd only interviewed on the phone, and they hadn't realised that her skin wasn't white. And she turned up and they said, sorry, you can't work here, and sent her home again. Right. Because of where it was in Kuwait. Yeah, and the Kuwaiti kids would not have. She was, I think she was Indian descent. She was a lovely lady, very, very intelligent and bright. And I'm sure she would have been fine. But the school that I was working in weren't going to have a teacher that wasn't white in there. Everyone had to be white and British. And most were blue-eyed. It was a bit weird. I stayed for 1 year, yeah, because I met my husband while I was there. So I then followed him to Dubai. But there was a very high turnover of staff on the whole. You had a few key members of staff who stayed for a very, very long time. Yeah, you used to hear of, not in the school that I was working in, but in other schools, there was rumours of teachers who actually didn't teach much during the day, but they had their contact details up there for the after-school class. Which they charged extra for.
Then you went to Dubai and you worked again, yeah, in a school.
Yes, when I went to Dubai, I went and worked in an international school in Dubai, this time teaching the International Baccalaureate. And that was fabulous because it was a complete mix of people and students from many different places in the world. It was 2-year teacher contracts at that place. So it wasn't quite as bad. You felt like you had a little bit more security.
And what did you feel about the students and parents at that school? How was it different to your previous school?
I'd say it was more of an international mix. Yeah, definitely. You had a lot more of a mix of both students and teachers. So the teachers were more of an international mix, whereas the English school I was at in Kuwait, most of the teachers were English as well. So it was great from my point of view to be working with people from different places, because the students were as well. It gave them a better mix, I think.
And what did you think of the teaching styles in the two schools? Did you have to change your teaching style at all?
Definitely. The teaching in the school in Kuwait, they got as many students into each classroom as they could. Some classrooms, you could hardly close the doors. So it was literally stood at the board teaching, which wasn't something I'd done in the UK anyway. So when I then went to Dubai, the classrooms, we had much smaller classroom sizes with students. And as a teacher, you could just be a lot more hands-on and teach in many, many different styles to suit the kids that you had.
Then your husband was moved again, or what? How did that
No, he stayed in Dubai, but I wanted to move. and I needed to change. And I got offered a promotion, so I moved to Qatar. It was still International Baccalaureate, so it was within the same teaching that I'd been doing. It was the same syllabus that I'd been teaching, but it was a promotion. It was better money, and it, unusually for a teacher, it was a job that came with a house as well.
Was it also a for-profit school?
No, this one wasn't. It was part of Qatar Foundation, and it was a very small elite boarding school for boys.
Wow. So what was that like in terms of the teaching experience?
Completely different. It was all Muslim boys. There was no international mix in that way. And it was extremely small classes. I had some classes of 3 or 4 students. It's almost individual conversations, but it's also sometimes harder for the students because they tend to learn so much from each other as much as they do from the teacher. I taught English and media and things like that. So a lot of what you learn in the classroom is bouncing ideas off each other. And sometimes it can be harder with the smaller classes. There were boys from Qatar, from Oman, from Saudi, from Kuwait. We didn't have any from the UAE. There's obviously been a bit of a problem between the UAE and Qatar, even back then. The boys tended to be the ones that are going to be the next rulers of the UAE. They were the relatives of the prime ministers and people like that.
So what was the parental involvement like then?
Well, because it was a boarding school, we didn't see parents as often as you would with an ordinary school. Some parents we never actually saw. Some parents never came to any events. And you could see the difference in the children where those ones that didn't turn up ever. Others just tended to be like every other normal parent, really. They tended to have our phone numbers and our email addresses, which you wouldn't have in a normal school. Because of the type of school it was, we all did quite late, long days as well. So we did a lot of after school activities with them and extra sessions with them after school, which was all part of our job. Even as much as taking them out of the school and taking them off somewhere for dinner so they could get out of the school setting occasionally and away from the school canteen. So, yeah, I did speak to parents probably more than I did in any other school, in a way. It was the same as it would have been in any school in the Middle East, that you had to have your shoulders, knees covered, elbows covered as well, which I would do as a teacher anyway, teaching teenage boys, yes, to be honest, anywhere in the world. You just don't need that hassle. You don't wear low-cut tops and mini skirts. Well, you shouldn't, I should say. I think the biggest thing I noticed was how much the boys really showed respect for us as women. There were a number of women who were expats, Western women working in the school, and the boys were very, very respectful.
Amanda and I talked for a long time, really, like nearly an hour, and we talked about a lot of things, and she's had so many great little snippets and tidbits and stories, and I'm just going to put a couple of them here now. There is no way to really connect them all, so they sound a little bit disjointed, but I didn't want anyone to miss out on them.
I was teaching in Dubai, and we had one girl who was a princess. She was one of the Dubai royalty, and she wanted to bring her pet lions to school one day, and I had to turn around and say, no, you're not allowed to. Well, why not? I said, because you can't bring lions to school. But miss, I said, no. So they don't come through that school gate. And she looked at me and she winked. The next thing I know, there's a car outside with a lion with its head sticking out the window. There were two of them. Each had their own driver. They had a driver and a handler each, and they came along to school. When I was first in Kuwait, and we had this big iron gate at the school yard that opened for the students to come in at the start of the school day. The students didn't come in the front entrance of the school. They came in this big iron gate. And I remember the first time being there at the end of school and seeing these students, and they were all different nationalities. They'd walk out the school gate and they'd just drop their school bags at the feet of the maids who were then waiting to pick them up and carry them to the cars for them. And my jaw just hit the floor. I nearly didn't leave. I did get up. My husband, right at the last minute, I think it was just before the movers actually came, he got offered a job in Qatar. And I got asked by a princess to open a school for her.
That is a sentence. Did you ever think you would say that sentence?
No.
I loved Amanda. Now, we have to put a link because Amanda takes the most amazing Instagram shots of her life in Greece. So I'll make sure that I put a link in the show notes on that one. Wasn't she amazing just to show the people that she met and the variety of students, and also that little eye-opener that it's not all just about the expat kids, it's a lot about the local kids you're dealing with as well.
Yeah, I was fascinated by everything she had to say. I also thought the variety of schools that she worked in was very interesting. The fact that in Kuwait it was a for-profit school, but it was still had huge class sizes and a lot of local children versus her Dubai school. And the Qatar school sounded amazing. And she actually told me that that was not in Doha that was out sort of in a town a little bit far away. So it was sort of socially, geographically and socially a little bit isolated. There wasn't a whole heap of stuff to do.
I thought also I'd love to hear more about, and maybe we can have someone phone in and tell us about this. And when I say phone in, I mean go onto the website and to fatexpats.com and you'll see a little microphone there and you can leave us a message. But I would love to hear from teachers about how they feel the recruitment process has evolved, because it wasn't it interesting when Amanda said how when she started, you know, there was no Skype, it was all over the phone and, you know, you just sent off your resume. Whereas now I'm, you know, aware that there's these huge teachers recruiting fairs, you know, where you go to the recruiting fair for a week and you shop schools and you shop out your resume and you, you know, interview with lots of different schools. You know, there's a whole process to it. And I know here it's really, really harrowing for some teachers because they have to put in their resignation before they can, you know, fess up that they're on their way to the recruiting fair and that they'll be looking for another gig. I had really good friends here last year who, you know, resigned here but had 6 months of not knowing where was next while they interviewed and very luckily, well, not luckily, I'm sure they thoroughly deserved the role, but they felt very lucky that they ended up in Singapore with a great gig in Singapore. And I'm insanely jealous of them now because they're living in a great place and then eating lots of great food and doing whatever. But, yeah, I think, you know, hasn't that changed?
Yeah, absolutely. Like when she said there was no Skype, I was like, oh. She said, but it was in 2006. I was like, wow, that's, wow, just weird to think that just that short time ago that just didn't exist.
Yeah. I thought Skype did though in 2000. I was using Skype back then. Were you using Skype back then?
Oh, I mean,
I remember it was really terrible. But
yeah, I think that's it's really terrible. So people didn't use it for sort of interviews or meetings. They just sort of used it, you know.
Yeah, I think we get so concerned about what we'll be with our kids, and I thought it was interesting. We had, you know, a few wise, sage women there whose children were now adults and they'd gone through the university system and they'd all sort of pulled through. And I think that is the one thing that we need to remember is, you know, that we're all concerned about our kids. We're all paying so much attention to how their education's going. It's very easy to get panicked about whether you're doing the right thing or the wrong thing, like in anything with parenting. And that, we did not have one person that came out and said, this expat life completely ruined my child and my child's education.
No, we did have one person who said who was unhappy that they had to finish school when they were 20 because they'd gone through different schooling systems and then had to catch up when they went back. But yes, we didn't have that.
The other thing we haven't talked about, Nikki, is the cost involved. And I know we kind of touched on it when people were saying, you know, you should have a not-for-profit school, which I think is great advice. And I thought, you know, we had a couple of people that said the principal of the school was also the owner of the school, and that was a massive red flag, which I reckon it would be. We have that same sort of situation does happen here in Doha as well. Or you've got to be really interested in who's on the board of your school and if your school is attached to an embassy or not, and decisions that might get made in regards to that. Our school here has had a major shift of focus from when we first came here to sort of 8 years down the track of the admissions procedure and whether they are more an American school or an international school and, you know, who gets in first. And that changes the whole culture of a school, right, when you're looking at that sort of thing. But the big one for me is the cost, because there is this, you know, perceived idea. I think the statistics, I've got an article here that I'll attach that's from ECA International, and it looks at the rising cost of international school fees. But in there they quote that 80% of international schools, the fees are usually paid by the company. And I know for my husband, he gets really irate when people say, oh, yeah, but you get your school fees for free. And because his whole thing is, no, 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 no. You know, it's part of my package. It's part of my allowance. You know, don't be thinking I've just got a free gig here or I've got, you know, that was just a nice little sweetener. You know, it is, I see it as part of my money that goes towards the school. So you have, I think there's this whole attitude of, you know, and particularly in countries like the Middle East, when people see it as oil money and, you know, big wealthy companies that, you know, have these, you know, endless buckets, it seems, of money to tip into a school. You know, I heard the most outrageous thing the other day with a school that shall remain nameless, of parents, you know, have to bring back supplies at the beginning of the year, which I think goes back to the old days where, you know, you couldn't get those supplies within that country. So you got them on your summer break and you went home and you bought, you know, 4 A4 pads and 20 texters and, you know, 3 red pens and, you know, whatever, and a glue stick and whatever, and you bought back your bag. And on the first day of school, everyone lugs in with their shopping bag full of supplies, which go into a cupboard for everybody to share. Now, you can imagine for most parents, it's a bit of a pain in the bum going and buying all the school supplies, you know, from the shopping list while they're home on their vacation, and then putting it all in the suitcase and traveling back with it and, you know, getting it all back. And I heard this story the other day that this particular school, that at the end of the year, they have so many supplies left over that they put them all on a table in the middle of the room, and all of the teacher's assistants and staff at the school can just take what they...
And oh, my goodness.
Home. Yes. And, you know, that to me, you know, you often hear with schools... with, you know, when they've got the indoor pool and the outdoor pool and the rock climbing wall and the special turf. And, you know, I know there was a school in Beijing that was building a roof over the top of it, you know, to try and look after the issue of pollution. And, you know, you do see these extravagant facilities in these schools, and they are like little mini Disneylands in the places that they're from. I think that's interesting, A, to look at cost, and B, to look at how much gets removed from education and sold on facilities.
Yeah, which is insightful in that it's a lot of those are for-profit schools, right? So, but they still have the Disneyland aspect. And then, so I was asking about schools. I was referring to this discussion in another Facebook group that I belong to, which is the Expat Kids Learning Differently, because a lot of kids... which have special needs or learning support requirements aren't accepted into these schools.
Yes.
Because they say they can't fund a learning support department.
Yes. Yet
they can fund all this other stuff, which to me, I mean, the key of education is learning support. You know, it's supporting all the children. And that was one thing that Kelly mentioned, that in Singapore, she doesn't see, you know, she feels that her children aren't exposed to a lot of diversity in educational requirements because the school doesn't accept those kind of children. You know, doesn't accept those children, and she feels that since Australia, that her children haven't, you know, they don't understand that some kids learn differently or have different requirements.
Yes, yeah. Like, instead of maybe building a brand new library, maybe we could build a support centre, you know, for children, you know, to welcome special needs children into the school. Yeah, could not agree more.
Or fund a few teachers.
Yeah, or fund a few teachers. And yeah, and that's where I think the strategic planning is really interesting with international schools. And this is just one of my other ponderings of being around for 18 years of watching this, is the lack of accountability as well when people are constantly on the move. So, you know, one of the things I asked in that question was, what happens when the person who implemented the change to the math system and said, you know what, guys, we're not going to do it this way, now we're going to do it that way, and that person writes it on their CV, how amazing am I? I implemented a new system, gets themselves a great promotion to go off and be the next principal, whatever. What happens when 5 years down the track someone goes, do you know what, that was probably a little dumb and... it's not working and we need to go back. And these are things that, if you're in your home country where these things are governed, and you know the government, I know that Sharon raised a really good point that you know these changes can happen within your home country when there's a new government comes in and that new government decides that there's going to be a new way of doing things. But at least there is some governance. Oh dear. Anyway, I thought it was a great discussion and I loved the interviews that you did, Nikki. I thought they were really fantastic and gave sort of two sides of the story. And I seriously hope I haven't offended any teachers, because I couldn't survive without the expat teachers that I've had. And I've always been amazed at the quality of expat teachers that we've had too.
I mean teachers to me, I just bow down to them and I say, you know, I have no words, because what you do is beyond my comprehension.
Yeah, and I think especially expat teachers, because I think, you know, Amanda touched on it, on the expectations of expat parents. And you know, I do sincerely mean that. I'm not just trying to cover my tracks, in that for me it's very much the school as a whole where I have my issues. I think expat teachers are incredible individuals, in that they've, you know, quite often they've chosen not to stay within a system where they're getting you know, their pension fund and their super and, you know, whatever. They've chosen to branch out and travel, and you know, they have very similar ideals and philosophies as the parents of the kids that they're teaching. You know, they're all there for the same reason, and I think they have to deal with so much. I mean, the teachers at the school that my kids are at work incredibly long days, and there is a big expectation for them to do so. So yeah, I think I want to be really clear that I think my guys have been so lucky to have been exposed to an incredible wealth of knowledge just from the different nationalities and different ways of teaching and whatever. I think where it's been unfortunate for my kids a few times has been the actual school as a whole, of the change that happens with the people that float through it.
Yeah. More on the admin side.
Yeah.
So the administrators can send us the hate mail. That's why.
Yes. Okay. So Nikki, podcast. You had a 13-hour road trip. Tell me about it. What were you listening to?
Well, as I've mentioned, we listened to some science verses. I had to think about family friendly. So my kids are a bit older, so they don't want to listen to necessary podcasts aimed at kids. They want to sort of listen to adulty podcasts, but not, you know, so many podcasts are have a lot of language in them and also have some sort of the adult themes.
Yes.
So it was interesting to sort through that. So we found No Such Thing as a Fish was excellent. My kids loved it. So that was good. And I've talked about that before on the podcast. Yes. And Science Versus, we also listened to together. And one thing we did listen to, and I think you're also going to talk about it, it's one of our favourite podcasts, Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Yes.
There was a Hugh Remington two-part podcast interview.
Yes.
So it was almost 2 hours long. I don't know if you've listened to it, but it was really quite amazing. And obviously he's written a book and that's why he did the interview. But there's just the story of his life, in that, you know, he was a teenager and when he was 15 he tried to commit suicide. And because he was at a point of his life where he felt all these things. He also talked about when he was a teenager that he used to feel that he could see things sort of out of the corner of his eye, that he knew in his mind intelligently that weren't there, but he felt he could see things. And that's, you know, for us, it's very personal. And it's also a sign of anxiety, which, you know, which probably people know now, but at the time he didn't know that, and he wouldn't have had any sort of feedback on that. So I just thought it's really interesting. And then he's gone on to this amazing career, and we're in Hong Kong the same time he was in Hong Kong, but the places that he's worked and the people that he's met, and you know, he's been in a lot of war zones. He was in Fiji during the coup. So it was very, you know, the story of his reportage of life is because sort of, I guess he's just a bit older than us, or the same age, sort of followed along a lot of our things that we remembered about our life, my husband and I. So we just really, really enjoyed that particular podcast.
Yeah.
And he's of course, Australian as well.
great storyteller, Hugh Remington as well, isn't he? And like I've said, I think Richard Feidler is the best. I think Conversations with Richard Feidler is, you know, there's a reason that podcast has stayed in the top 10, you know, for as long as it has. Yeah. I listened to Richard Feidler talk to Helen Razor, which is an old interview, because I remember when Helen Razor did this a couple of years ago, she split up with her partner and was devastated and heartbroken and went off on a search of doing 100 dates. So I listened to the interview about what it's called, What Becomes of the Brokenhearted. And what I really enjoyed about it, though, was Helen Razor is the same age as me, or about the same age as me. And so when she dated the first time, it was very much go to a bar, meet a person, go out for dinner, da-da-da. And now, of course, it's modern-day dating. And it was a real insight into what modern-day dating looks like. So I really enjoyed that. There's another podcast at the moment called Headroom, which has got James Valentine, who also is of the same vintage of Helen Razor. He was on Triple J back in the day. But I love Headroom. It's one of those ones, probably, you know, average podcast is about 20 minutes. It's taken from his radio show. It's really well produced and put together. So a few of the Headroom episodes were, he had one on home remedies and different people ringing in with the home remedies, the pay for a wart and it would disappear. I personally identified with, because my uncle paid me for my wart and it did disappear. half an onion to rub on a jellyfish sting, leeches on cauliflower ears, and one woman saying about making her kids hold a potato for car sickness, and that all of these things worked. He had a really funny one called Tiny Issue, Big Argument, and people rang in to talk about the things that they argue about with their partners. And there were just some rippers, like a couple who were married and how much Vegemite to put in your toast, which really didn't matter when it was just them and they were married, but now that they have children is becoming a huge issue that they fight over.
Yes. I mean, not Vegemite, but we have the same issue with butter. Oh, in our house so much.
Yes. He had whether the pegs get left on the clothesline or not.
Bought in is the answer.
I'm going to leave them there. My mother is a present. Oh. I'm going to leave them there. What the Wi-Fi password should be, and getting shut down for choosing a ridiculous Wi-Fi password. And then another podcast I was listening to this week, and we've talked about it before, Ladies, We Need to Talk. But I thought it well worth listening to the one on Fat Talk. And, you know, Nikki, you and I have just had a discussion before about the 16-8 and, you know, losing weight and et cetera. This one was very insightful in that Yumi Steins brought in a person who writes about her size and the issues of being what she refers to as a fat woman. And I just thought it was a really, Yumi sort of said about how she's been trying for the last 2 years not to comment on women's appearances, and how she no longer says tall or short or pretty or ugly or whatever. And I thought that was really, really good. Okay, so Nikki, any books, dare I ask?
The only books I've been reading were guidebooks, Kirsty. Guidebooks about Brussels, guidebooks about Paris.
Fair enough, too.
What about you?
Okay, well, me, obviously we're moving on to the book group book, so I will talk about that next week. Screens. I have done a bit of viewing in the last little while. So we watched The Founder, which is the story of Ray Kroc, who, of course, is the guy who claims he started McDonald's. But when you watch the movie, you sort of hear the story of Mac and Dick McDonald, who had a burger operation in Southern California. And Ray Kroc was the traveling salesman who sort of discovered them and saw that there was a real opportunity for a franchise there, because they had this really speedy system of making food. I thought this was brilliant. It's got Michael Keaton in it, and he plays Ray Kroc. It was so interesting to see that the original burgers were incredibly tasty, and that there was so much with the McDonald's brothers that it was all about taste and food and, you know, enjoying it, and to what they have evolved in today. It was really, really good. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't, but I heard about it on a podcast recently. Is that where you heard about it, or you just found it when you were flicking through it?
Well, and it's actually, I'm going to have to give my husband full credit for this one. I saw it and he said, I wanted to watch that ages ago and the boys didn't want to watch it. They thought it looked boring. And so it was like, well, I think we should watch it. And it was really, really good. It was brilliant.
I'll put it on the list.
Yeah, it totally worth, you should go and watch it with the kids today. I think they'd find it quite interesting. Sam would definitely find it interesting. The guy was an absolute whiz for creating the franchise. But, yeah, there's also great sadness in the story as well for the McDonald's brothers, really. I had no idea there was that story. And Ray Kroc really sold it that he was the founder of McDonald's, so I think a lot of people didn't know about the McDonald's brothers.
Yeah, it's. I heard I can't remember the podcast. I remember I was in the supermarket because I was like, oh, I'm hearing about food and I'm buying food, but I can't remember what the podcast.
Now, the other thing that we've been watching, what is, and back to watching Australian television series for my children, is we're watching Doctor Doctor, which is one of those classic Channel 9, you know, Australian television series. The guy was a surgeon in Sydney, played up, gets sent to the country for a year for his sins, and ends up being a local GP at the hospital. I guess maybe a modern day a country practice, but everybody's better looking and a little bit hipper. And I am loving it, absolutely loving it. You know, when you want television that you're not going to have to explain, that is a cheap, easy laugh, is pretty to look at, you know, takes you back to a place you want to be. It's got some great characters in it. I don't know if I would watch it if I was living in Australia, but it's a great way to be transported into Australia. So Doctor Doctor, and there's two seasons of, I think, available of it. There's one definitely on iTunes, and it's available on Nine now if you have access to Aussie TV. We are still watching Luther, although the other night after the episode where the woman got her tongue cut out, all four of us ended up sleeping together in the bed that night. So we haven't returned to Luther this last week. And I've just done the first episode of Big Little Lies, which I read, I don't know.
What?
I must have read that book years ago. I'm sure I talked about it on this podcast. I knew it was there. I knew it was available. But you know how I was saying the other week, when do you get to watch things that aren't appropriate for your children once your children get to an age and they're up all the time? Do you know? So
when you go to bed.
Yes, but that's the thing. I think we all go to bed at the same time. Like, I think I tend to put the kids to bed, you know, 8:30, do a bit of stuff. I don't know, we just don't get there. But we did. The other night we did stay up and watch Big Little Lies. Yeah, and thought it was great. And the one I haven't mentioned, which we started watching months ago, and I don't know whether I have mentioned it and I've forgotten, I'm not sure, was Glow. Did I talk about Glow?
Oh, I've seen Glow. Yeah. I don't know if you talked about it.
I don't know if we talked about it.
But how good.
It's so good. And that's the one, of course, on Netflix about women's wrestling. It has a fantastic soundtrack because it's set in the 80s, great hair, great outfits. Shows those sort of women of the 80s. I don't know if you were the same as me where you spent the first half of it trying to work out why you knew the lead character and then realised she was Pete's wife from Mad Men, but I just put everybody else out of their misery who now goes to watch it and goes, who is she? That's who she is. What about you? What have you watched?
Poldark, this current series of Poldark I'm just watching. I don't know what I'm watching it on. Maybe Netflix or maybe Masterpiece, the US channel. But I love it. I read the books, I think when I was quite young, I read the books sort of in the early 80s, I think. And now I'm watching the TV series and I think it's lovely. The scenery and the story, and it's just one of those old fashioned things you can just sort of get lost in. It's not quite Outlander, but it's, you know, it's almost the same.
And so what is it?
Have you seen any Poldark?
No.
Okay, so it's set in ye olden day Britain. And I'm not going to say exactly where, it's somewhere near a beach, and I'll offend English and British people everywhere if I say. He's just come back from the war, and the love of his life has married somebody else, and he has to sort of get on with his life. Oh. And it's about him trying to make his way, being a good moral person, and, you know, nobody else is, and oh, that kind of stuff. So,
and it's got all that pretty English countryside, has it?
Amazing, you know, cliff tops by beaches, windswept, everything, just really great.
Oh, that sounds pretty. Oh, that does sound nice. And where can I find Polder?
I am going to put the link up where you can find it. I'm not quite sure. I'll look into that.
Okay.
I've got so many TV channels that I watch. The other thing that I wanted to mention briefly that I forgot to mention last time was, it's filed under other, is there's this great, it's a video called The Party, and it's a virtual experience of autism. And it's a video where it's one of those things where 360, so you can move it around the room. So if you hear a sound or a voice, you can move the video and you can see. And it just basically shows sort of the sensory inputs of, if you're someone with autism, how that makes you, could make you feel, or what, or how it might impact you. And I remember when I was in South Africa and I was listening to this, it was a recording. It was the first time that it ever made sense to me about ADHD. So it was a recording of children sitting in a classroom. It says, if you're a child sitting in a classroom and your teacher's reading to you, this is what you hear. And it was just a teacher reading. You know, you heard her turning the page and whatever. And then it says, if you're a child with ADHD sitting on the floor in a classroom listening to your teacher read the book and you're sitting beside the other kid, this is what you hear. And you could hear a fly, and you could like hear the kid beside you moving their feet, and you could hear all the rustle of this and that and the other. And it just made it so clear to me the difference between, you know, what children can experience. And I think that this is the same thing, but on a visual scale and so much more complex, because you've got the whole 360 thing. And I just think if you have any interest in it all, it's really worthwhile just having a look at it.
Would love to watch that. Oh, okay, so it's called The Party, A Virtual Experience of Autism, and you'll put a link up on twofatexpats.com.
I'll put a link up.
I would love to watch that. Oh, wow. Okay. Well, Nikki, I think, are we done? I feel like this is going to be one of those massive... episodes.
It is, but there were so much important things to discuss and talk about. And who knows when we'll speak again, because you're on the plane to Australia, so we'll have to work out that out.
Yes. So, no, we'll definitely speak again. We'll just work it out for next week. But, yes, I'm on the plane on a Wednesday night, arriving in Adelaide on the Thursday afternoon. I've got 10 days to make all of these very important final decisions with our house, because, of course, our house is finished in the first week of December. So this is all the itty-bitty little last bits. So, yes, it got too hard trying to tell the fencing contractor where to put the fence over the phone. Decided maybe just might be easier to do these last few things, go through, walk through. But my kitchen is being installed as we speak, Nikki.
So is the house to lock up?
Yes, it's very much to lock up.
So will you be sleeping on a blow-up mattress in your bedroom?
No, because we don't have a sewage system at all.
Okay.
We don't have any tiles in the bathroom, or nor furniture nor anything. So I don't even think the toilets are in their spot. But yes, I am assured that first week of December they will be ready to hand over the keys.
Oh, so exciting. Well, yes. we wait to see another video. Some Facebook Live action.
I probably should do that. We should do a little video together.
That sounds great. Okay, well, happy packing, and we'll speak to you next week.
Okay, bye.
Bye.